Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I hope that you had a blessed Thanksgiving, and I know that one of the things that may or may not have come up on your news feed, or you know, certainly on the TV if you ever have any like cable news on in the airport or in the waiting room or the lobby or something where you work, people talk about inflation right now constantly. Inflation is just the hot topic of the day, right? Is there another housing bubble? Was the hot topic maybe 6 months ago or something? Now everybody wants to talk about it. Is inflation here to stay? So we're going to talk today, since this is a student loan podcast, we're going to talk about inflation in the context of student loans. Does inflation mean that IBR plans are a bad idea? So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about how inflation impacts your decision-making with refinancing. We're going to talk about some latest news about the PSLF waiver with some updated guidance from the Department of Education that'll be exciting. First, I want to start with a little history discussion. There is a guy named William Jennings Bryan. I think he ran for president a bazillion times. I think the other guy, like in from AP US history, right, that ran forever for president was like Eugene Debs. So like those guys, I don't know, come up for like most ambitiously running for president a gazillion times. So William Jennings Bryan, I think, ran against, don't quote me on this, but I think he ran against McKinley in like the early 1900s, late 1800s kind of time frame was when he was around. And back then, the U.S. was on something called the gold standard. So the idea is that, you know, a dollar was backed by a dollar's worth of gold that they would hold in Fort Knox somewhere. And because it was based on that, that meant that that was a check against inflation. That basically prevented the central bank from just issuing a ton of extra currency in times when there was a recession. And that was anti-inflationary. It caused prices to be really pretty stable. But the problem with that is if you have something that you can't expand the monetary supply, that can be deflationary. And what does that mean? Well, it sort of means that when the value of money basically increases in purchasing power. That hasn't happened really extensively since the Great Depression when we had like 30% deflation. So what is inflation? What is deflation? Well, think about a dollar. What is the value of a dollar? That's inflation and deflation. If the value of that dollar of what you can buy with it went down, that's inflation. If the amount of things you can buy with that dollar went up, well, that's called deflation. Economists tend to be a lot more scared about deflation than inflation. And the reason for that is with inflation, you want to spend everything right now because the price of the stuff you're trying to buy might go up tomorrow. So it's very stimulative of demand. Whereas deflation in the Great Depression, for example, if you think that the money stored under your mattress might buy more tomorrow, you're going to hold on to it. You're not going to spend anything, which causes a crash in demand in the economy. That's one of the reasons why we went off the gold standard in the 70s and why the central bank now, whenever there's a crisis, basically prints a bunch of money because of all this theory around sort of modern monetary theory and a bunch of economic fancy concepts that probably we don't need to talk about on this podcast. But the idea is that it's supposed to stabilize prices in the economy. That's really what the Federal Reserve's primary job is. Now, William Jennings Bryan, why did I bring him up? Because of his relationship to his political campaign and the debtors that supported him. So William Jennings Bryan, his primary campaign slogan was, or one of his big speeches that he gave, was a speech called, "Do Not Crucify America on a Cross of Gold." So what does that mean? William Jennings Bryan was super anti-gold standard. And I promise, by the way, we're going to bring this back to IBR. Okay, you might be thinking, oh my gosh, what is this guy? You know, he's crazy. But we're going to bring this back to IBR, I promise. What happened is farmers in America had a lot of debt at the time. And farmers, there was way higher percent of Americans that were farmers back in the 1800s than there are today. So, you know, farmers are still a very politically exciting or politically sexy demographic group today. But there's not that many of them now. But back then, there was a ton of farmers, and they would really swing elections in a big way. So that's why William Jennings Bryan made it his big campaign plank was basically fighting against the gold standard, because a bunch of farmers went bankrupt because they borrowed $100,000, let's say, to buy and plant a bunch of crops. And then the value of that $100,000, because of deflation, instead of $100,000, the cost of what they borrowed basically went way up because the value of their money plummeted with deflation. And now suddenly they're 10% more in debt because the value of their currency suffered from deflation. And so remember the gold standard, you couldn't just print gold. You couldn't just find a bunch of gold somewhere to print more paper. And so this gold standard, which the banks loved, was messing up the farmers who had all the debt. And so the banks wanted to keep the gold standard because it meant that if you borrowed $100,000, there was really no way to get out of it because you couldn't just inflate the money away and then wipe out all the debt with just printing money, right? And then the farmers hated the gold standard because they had all this debt that they really wanted it to be less impactful negatively on their lives because of all these boom and bust cycles that were happening in the late 1800s. So the farmers wanted something called the silver standard. And why? Because there was a ton of silver. You could find silver all over the place, right? If you think about every family in America, it seems like, you know, grandma's got some sort of silverware collection somewhere, right? So it's very common compared to gold. And so the idea was if you made, you know, the money based on silver, well, you could print a whole lot more of it and then bankers could create inflation. And then the $100,000 that you borrowed would only feel like maybe $50,000 because you're printing away the value of that money. And so this is the original battle of debtors against creditors. Debtors always want inflation. Bankers or creditors hate inflation because they want to make their money back and they don't want to have it inflated away where they're not getting the same amount of purchasing power that they lent somebody. So that's a kind of an interesting history lesson, right? Because it sets the tone for what I'm about to talk about. So almost every debtor wants inflation, you know, if you're just looking at it in isolation, because if you have inflation, that means as a debtor, you are going to make money because the cost of the money that you borrowed is basically going down in real purchasing power terms. So, you know, here's another example. My mom's first mortgage was 14% interest. So in the 1970s and early 90s, we had really bad inflation. That's one of the big reasons that Jimmy Carter did not win re-election was because inflation was really bad and it was causing a lot of economic pain for the average American household. It was double-digit inflation, so much so that the 10-year Treasury bond today maybe yields 1.5%. Back then, it was yielding 15% because inflation expectations were so bad. And with my mom paying 14% interest on her mortgage, about 99% of her mortgage payment every month went to paying the interest because the interest rate was so high. Today, my first mortgage rate was 2.75. Only about 60% of my payment goes to the interest. About 40% goes to paying off the principal. So there's a huge difference right there, and that's one reason why housing prices are so much higher is because interest rates are so much lower. It's very stimulative of housing prices. So what happened after the 80s and 90s? Well, we had very low inflation because of a bunch of different reasons. We had September 11th, which caused, well, maybe not caused, but certainly contributed to the stock market crash and recession that was underway after the dot-com bubble burst. And then we had the financial crisis in 2008, and you know, when I was a bond trader, people were obsessed with inflation. They talked about that all the time because that's how you lose money in bonds in a big way is if there's bad inflation. So people are always thinking about it as bond traders and portfolio managers. So people talked about back then in the 2000s and 2010s, they talked about, well, why is inflation so low? Why is it that we're printing money like crazy? We're doing a lot of stimulus and purchasing bonds along end of the curve. Like why is inflation, you know, why are people not pushing for higher interest rates or something like that? And the main reason that they gave was that the labor force participation rate was really low compared to the past. So think about the 1950s. What happened? Everybody came back from the war, and then a lot of those people got jobs after an initial period of dislocation. And then what happened? You have the 1950s sort of housewife stereotype, right, where women didn't work outside the home once they got married. And then in the 1960s, and then with the civil rights movement in the 60s, that started to change where more people of all backgrounds had more access to all different kinds of professions. So you had the labor force participation rate grow, and you had a lot more people with a lot more money to spend entering the economy. So if you think about, you know, the labor force participation rate is something people talk about all the time. I think it's like 60-something percent or something like that. That rate is kind of susceptible to a lot of different things. So that's one of the reasons, frankly, why the U.S. had such amazing economic growth in the 80s and 90s is because you tamed inflation, you had all these people coming into the workforce, growing the economic pie, and all this technology also being invented and being implemented, like stuff that was happening with the internet. And it was enormously stimulative for productivity growth. Because this labor force participation rate got worse in the 2000s and 2010s, that held down inflation, even though all central banks around the world were trying to do things to boost inflation. It turns out that even though they were doing a lot, the reason that there was no inflation is because they just weren't doing enough. and supply chains were not disrupted enough. So let's talk about like what is going on right now. Why is there such bad inflation? You know, we have had a low labor force participation rate for a while, but with COVID, that labor force participation rate got even worse. So it was already not very good, but then it got really bad. And why did it get bad? Well, if you have a child, this past 2 years has been a nightmare, right? If you're constantly in and out of quarantine, close contacts, you have to go get someone tested. The kids, if you're elementary school or middle school aged or high school aged, might be doing school at your dining room table. And, you know, heaven help you if the person's under 10, because then they need to be supervised to make sure they're actually doing it, right? And so that's been an absolute nightmare, especially disproportionately for women who bear the brunt of childcare duties and responsibilities. And then you've also had issues with people being afraid of getting COVID, dropping out of the workforce because of fears of that. And you've had a whole bunch of economic stimulus that's absolutely unprecedented. I think we've spent maybe like $5 or $6 trillion of fiscal stimulus, which back in the financial crisis, I think we only spent like $800 billion or something like that, whatever President Obama's stimulus plan was. It was a fraction of the size of what we've done with COVID relief. It's not even close. So what has happened to consumers is you've had supply chain disruptions. So if you want to buy a couch, we found two couches that, you know, we liked, and we found out that they were not available until March 2022. So do you go spend money on that couch, or do you maybe go find something that'll work off of Craigslist and just spend way less money? Right. So we went ahead and put in the order for the nice couch, but we're going to have to wait for forever. But a lot of people might make the opposite decision and say, you know what, I guess I just don't need it if it's going to take me a year to get it. Never mind. That's an example of the supply problems. People don't have the supply to buy stuff even when they want to buy stuff. On the same token, with all of the pandemic relief and the support and then the recovery in the labor market, certainly a lot of businesses, including ours, like kind of freaked out early in the pandemic thinking like, oh my gosh, like are we going to have to lay everyone off? And then we had that PPP program that supported payrolls, and we had a surge back in demand that supported businesses. And so, and then suddenly there wasn't enough workers because of the shortages in the labor force, especially in the lower paid end of the scale, where you have to actually physically be somewhere. You know, there was just not a lot of people interested in doing those jobs for the wages that they were being offered, right? And then people that had their hours initially trimmed were in some cases eligible to get more money for not working than working. You know, if that was me, I would stay home. I'm just being honest, like that's rational, right? If you are scared about getting sick from the pandemic and you have childcare problems and you have access to support where you don't have to work, why would you not take advantage of that? Like, it's like kind of what I say to people that feel guilty about taking advantage of the student loan forgiveness rules. You didn't write the rules, you don't control them, but you're absolutely going to pay taxes, if not now, later, to pay for all programs that exist. Therefore, you should take full advantage legally within the bounds of the law of any program that exists, and don't feel guilty about it because it is what it is. So let's talk about what's going on with consumers' balance sheets. So the other thing that's causing inflation right now is there's insanely high bank account deposits. So before the pandemic, there was about $13.5 trillion of assets in cash in banks. A year before that, in 2019, it was about $12.8 trillion. So in other words, it grows by a few hundred billion a year. With the pandemic, it's now at $17.7 trillion. So it grew $4.2 trillion in like a year and a half when it usually grows a few hundred billion. So that is by far the fastest increase in cash savings for consumers ever in history, not even close. So think about it. You have more people with more money than they've ever had in their lives. You've had nowhere to spend money because even if you can spend money, there's all these disruptions. There's all this like stress of everything. Am I going to be exposed, or you know, am I going to be able to go and enjoy this restaurant with the having to book it at 5 p.m. to go to the restaurant instead of my usual time where I just show up at 7:30 and don't have to wait for a table. So again, harder to spend money, supply chain disruptions, way more government spending and pandemic relief money and higher wages, and so way higher cash savings and demand. And so there's this huge supply-demand imbalance. So what happens? Initially, what people have done is had people line up in a queue, line up in a line, right? You go to your favorite restaurant, there's a line out the door that's way longer than there ever was before. That's a form of rationing, right? So that's one way to like meet that supply demand imbalance without raising prices. But what some people are having to do, some businesses are having to do, is they're saying, wait a second, it doesn't make sense that we're turning away like all these people that would pay, because that's not revenue maximizing. And so what we'll do instead is we'll raise prices, and then some of the people will see those prices and leave the line, but then we'll have a line that we can actually serve, and we'll be able to pay our workers more, and that way we'll be able to attract the workers that we want to attract. And the danger there is that's a wage price spiral. If that starts happening like on a macro scale, that's how you like lose control of the economy and end up back in the 1970s again. Now, the good news is some experts in the economy say, hey, wait a second, this is just a transitory problem. This is growing pains of coming out of this terrible pandemic that will eventually in the next few months dissipate, because we'll get the supply chains running again. People will spend down their savings, and so there won't be as much crazy demand as there is right now. And so, yeah, there'll be some temporary inflation, and it'll be painful short-term, but it's just going to be long-term fine. And there's precedent for this. In World War II, everybody came home from the war. There was all this demand and not enough people to supply it because of the disruption in the war. And there was inflation, I think, of like, I don't know, 10, 15% for 1 year, and then it normalized and got normal again. So that makes a lot of sense. The other kind of flip side to that is the 1970s, where the economy, the central bank, kind of just lost control of inflation expectations and it got bad, and we saw double-digit inflation. What does that mean for student loans? Remember I said earlier that historically debtors love inflation, like the farmers, right? The farmers, they want inflation so that the value of their mortgages are less and the banks have to eat it, and then they get to own the land and not have to worry about paying back as much in terms of purchasing power back to the banks. So in other words, debtors, people that are borrowers, they borrowers like inflation. But if you are an IBR borrower, you don't like inflation. And let's talk about why. First of all, let's compare your alternatives. What is the alternative to income-based repayment? Well, it's refinancing. Right now, you can still get interest rates in the twos and threes with refinancing. Back a couple years ago, because I've done this for over 5 years now, back in 2017, 2018, my typical interest rate that I would get a client with doing a refinancing for 20-year fixed was 5%. Now it's maybe 3% in some cases. So that's not going to last. I don't know when it's going to end, but I don't think that lasts, because that's just insanely low. But what happens to IBR, though, if incomes go up and there's inflation, right? So remember, somebody who refinances their student loan would like inflation, because that means that their incomes are rising while their debt and their payments are staying the same. Whereas with IBR, if your income goes up, your payments are going up. So first off, remember that worst case scenario, your student loan is just a student loan with the interest rate that you have. So if there's 15% inflation, or IBR payments would be soaring or something, well, worst case scenario, you can always just pay back your 6% student loan. And maybe 6% is a pretty low interest rate. Maybe it's not as low as you could have gotten, but it's not terrible, right? So remember that that's your worst case scenario. So don't freak out or anything. Certainly don't want to freak you out with this episode. I just want to talk about it, because I'm sure it's something that if you're not thinking about, maybe will eventually come up in conversation. I ran some numbers of someone, just real world example, to give some actual stories to this. Let's say, when I say IBR, I mean all of the IBR plans, right? Like pay-as-you-earn is inclusive of that. So I ran somebody who has 200K in debt with 100K of income, 2-to-1 debt-to-income ratio, 200K of student debt, 100K of income. And let's say that inflation rate is 6%. Today, this past year, inflation was 6%. So in other words, what if the bad inflation that we had this year continues forever? If we compare that person getting a 3% 20-year fixed rate, so those numbers in today's dollars are kind of similar. So if you take away the tax bomb, though, it's not similar. Keep this in mind. When we're comparing pay-as-you-earn to refinancing, a lot of times we are looking at pay-as-you-earn with the tax bomb included, when it's pretty likely, I think, that tax bomb will be eliminated at some point. So you have to think about that. The other debt-to-income ratio I ran was 1.5. So if you do a debt-to-income ratio of 1.5-to-1 instead of 2-to-1, so in other words, somebody who has less debt relative to income. So the first scenario I ran was 200K of debt, 100K of income. The second scenario I ran was 200K of debt, but 133K of income. That ratio is 1.5. So in other words, the person has more income relative to their debt. So in that case, refinancing is the winner. Refinancing wins fairly significantly over pay-as-you-earn. And then if you look at a 4% interest rate instead of 3 for 20-year fixed, well, then it's tied with pay-as-you-earn without a tax bomb, but it is better than pay-as-you-earn with a tax bomb. So what does that mean? Like, let me translate that for you. If you are a believer in there being inflation that is above the historical averages, then what we tell people is if you are in the private sector and you have a debt smaller than your income, or expect you will have, you know, higher income than your debt soon, that you can pay it back. You need to plan on paying it back. It's not a lot of scenarios where you want it. You need to refinance. If you have twice your income in student debt or more, then it's very unlikely that you would not be better off doing forgiveness of some kind. Maybe the 20-year version, right? Figure out maybe repay with 25 years, that kind of thing. If you're in between that, 1x your income in debt and 2x your income in debt, if you're somewhere in between that, or you expect you're going to be in that ratio very soon, it's a toss-up. And so you have to make some value decisions. You have to decide if you believe the tax bomb is likely or unlikely. You have to decide how much, you know, you enjoy bureaucracy and having to recertify your income every year. You have to decide how much the psychological toll being in debt takes on you. You have to decide if paying off your debt fast would be motivating to you psychologically, where you would gain happiness from being debt-free faster than 20 years. You have to decide if paying your debt really fast would deprive your family of big, important life experiences and impact major life decisions like when to have kids, when to get married, when to buy a house, where that's extremely important as well. I'm a huge fan of figure out your life first, then figure out your loans, because the loans need to fit those life goals. Otherwise, you're setting yourself up for unhappiness. And I've seen some very sad, unhappy people that have a lot of money that paid off their loans really rapidly. And I've seen a lot of happy people that have a lot of debt that are paying the minimum on their loans. And I've seen the flip side as well, of course. And then the reason why someone's generally happy or unhappy is because, are their goals matching their finances? If those goals are not matching the finances, then that's a recipe for current or future unhappiness. So that's what you really got to watch out for. Now, a couple other things to think about with inflation in terms of your student loans. Keep in mind that if there is inflation, that the poverty line that they deduct before you have to pay 10% of your income, that poverty line would grow with inflation too. And, you know, how big is your income relative to that poverty line? So remember, for a family of two, that federal poverty line is around $18,000. So if you're a couple of teachers, that's a fairly significant percent of your income. But if you're a couple of dentists, then it's not, right? Then that deduction is fairly small compared to your combined income. So in other words, if you're a five-figure income couple, then inflation might not impact your payments as much as you think, because that deduction they give you is going to grow with inflation too. Even though your payment would go up and, you know, incomes would go up with your incomes, you'd also get a higher deduction over time, which would mitigate that a little bit. But if you're a six-figure income earner, the growth of that federal poverty line deduction is probably not as good. Another thing to think about too is when you're leaving the security of federal programs, you give up forever all of the benefits that exist, that some of which we maybe not have even thought of yet, such as the new IBR plan, yet to be named, that will be coming out at some point in the next year or two, that may or may not be better than what is out there currently. And when you refinance, you're off the federal system now and forever, including any future special freezes on interest and payments, like they happened for almost 2 years. Now, the good news for people refinancing, I'll say, is I think it's extremely unlikely that they'll ever freeze student loans for 2 years again. This was really extraordinary. This was hopefully once in a lifetime kind of a situation in terms of a national disaster. And, you know, if you do it once, you're sure you're more likely to do it again because you've proven that you can do it. But at the same time, I think that I feel fairly confident to say that if you're not going to cancel student loans, if policy-wise, if they can't make it happen, then freezing them multiple times would be very difficult to administer that and have expectations of people paying their debt. And then you'd have this, I don't know, it'd be an interesting situation, I guess. I would say if we had a 2008, I think now there's a chance that they would pause payments again. Whereas I would say, no, they wouldn't for the past. So it just depends. I mean, if it has to be a national disaster, like you have to have it declared as a national disaster. So I don't know if a recession would qualify, to be honest with you. You have to talk to a legal person. Anyways, I do think that the protections of the government for lower income people are very important for when you're thinking about leaving that federal security of the student loan program. Higher income people, less of a concern. Now, let's talk a little bit briefly about the PSLF waiver, some latest updates of things that we found online. So we looked in the Department of Education official guidance, and we found something we haven't found before, which says, what if you consolidate multiple loans that had different numbers of qualifying payments on them, which one would be taken on that new consolidation loan? Department of Ed, on their website, we just saw it today, said that they will take the highest number of payments on whoever loan has the highest number of payments for that new direct consolidation loan, as long as those loans were overlapping in their payment history. What does that mean? Let's say that you have got 10 different subsidized and unsubsidized and grad plus loans that were on the wrong repayment plan. Let's say you started paying on the ones, you know, let's just say that you have 2 payments on some of them, 4 payments on some of them, 8 payments on some of them. What we're saying is previously we were wondering if you consolidate those, you're supposed to count those previous payments, but how much are you supposed to count? 2, 4, or 8? And now Department of Education is saying 8. That's a big deal. That's going to expand forgiveness to a lot of people. So we're going to continue following those updates to make sure that you're updated on that. What we're doing in our consults is like looking at people's loan histories and seeing those previous payments that were made with the program that we have that like searches the NSLDS data. And we're trying to help people figure out exactly like how much PSLF additional credit they should qualify for so they can kind of check against what the government is telling them. There's another big update with the PSLF waiver. We also found that, at least according to some FAQs that we saw out there, that any payment of any kind, as long as you're working full-time at a public sector employer with federal student loans, any payment at all counts until October 2021. But after that, the only payments that can count that are not IBR plans or standard tenure plans are for payments you make on a loan that you're going to consolidate into a new loan by October 2022. Here's an example. We have consultant meetings every 2 to 3 weeks to talk about hard cases, to go over any kind of things that are stumping people, to make sure everyone's up to date on the latest updates, politically, legislatively, regulatory, et cetera, because we really want to make sure that we're the absolute best at this in the world, and that means we have to have a consistent experience for clients. So in having that joint meeting, the thing we talked about this week is somebody brought up a case where this guy was on the extended plan for a really long time. He had a consolidation loan that he was paying the extended plan on. Obviously, that's not a qualifying plan for PSLF. I shouldn't say obviously. That's probably not obvious to a lot of people, I guess, but not a qualifying plan. With the PSLF waiver, though, any payment plan counts. So suddenly, this guy had 85 payments out of the 120 that he needed, which was awesome. But the question that he had was, wait a second, my extended payment is way lower than if I switch to repay or ICR, because he didn't qualify for the standard tenure because those were consolidated loans, and he didn't have a partial financial hardship anymore because his income was more than his debt. With the thing that he was considering is, well, could he just stay on the extended plan until October 2022 to get lower payments? We settled on no because of this guidance from the Department of Education. But if he had had non-consolidated loans, then the answer would have been yes. So clear as mud, right? Lots of decisions over this PSLF waiver. You know, that's one of the reasons our bookings have like quadrupled. This past week, we had over 100 consultations. You know, that's a typical number for us during the pandemic, at least for like a month. So we're under a lot of strain. I mean, you know, our consultants are doing everything they can to increase availability. People are opening up evenings, they're opening up weekends. We're trying to like let them know too, to like take it easy. Like, I think people understand right now that there's lots of waits for services that people enjoy because of the economy and because of everything that's happening with like people having way more cash than services and products to spend it on because of the supply-demand imbalance right now, right? With student loans, obviously people like a student loan plan like they need a toothache. But you know, it's that you don't really want to pay for something like that unless you need it. But I think that that's what we're finding is with this PSLF waiver, there's all these nuanced rules. There's all these like special I's to dot, T's to cross that we're finding with all this new guidance. So that's just an update on the PSLF waiver stuff. One thing I will say about inflation, let's talk about inflation again. What we like to do is when we make a plan for somebody, we want to make sure those are stress tested, so that any moderate economic shocks, like a little bit of unexpected inflation, would have no bearing on your long-term plan. Now, if you have a big economic shock, those can be a macro shock or a micro shock. A macro shock is inflation in the economy is 15%. We were expecting 3, and it's not 6, it's 15. Oh my gosh, what do we do? That's a macro shock. And then a micro shock is my income is going up 15% a year, even though the economy is 3% inflation, because I'm knocking it out of the park. My boss is giving me raises. I'm having a ton of success at work and getting bonuses. And I was making a lot more money than I thought I was going to make. So we've seen, you know, a lot of, so far, because we haven't done this for like decades, we've seen a lot of those micro changes with follow-up consults where somebody will come back and say, hey, I thought I was going to make this, and now I'm making 3 times more. And we've also had people go the other direction where people have said, I used to be in big law, but I got burned out, and now I absolutely love what I do, doing public interest work and doing legal defense work. And I'm so passionate about what I do, and I wake up happy every morning. That's like the big micro shocks and macro shocks are reasons that you might change course with your student loan plan. But a good one is stress tested to work under a lot of different scenarios. Remember that inflation is a positive for refinancing. It makes refinancing look better because you keep that 3 or 4 or 2% interest rate, even though inflation in the economy is 6%. Remember, too, your inflation can be worse than the overall economy's inflation. So if you're a nurse, the inflation in your wages that you've experienced over the past year and a half has been absolutely insane. I know this because my mom worked for decades as a nurse and is retired now, and I think maybe keeps her license active for, I don't know, stimulating her brain or something. It was something to do and to take the licensing tests in retirement, I guess. I don't know why she does it because it's a lot of work. But she got inundated with all these offers like randomly just because that they saw her name as like an unemployed nurse on the state licensed board or something, I guess. And they, people were like, come out and earn, you know, $100 an hour or $50 an hour or something like that. And I think she, when she was a nurse, maybe made like $30 an hour or something. And she called me and she was like, oh my gosh, Travis, this is amazing. I could go, you know, be a travel nurse and make this gazillion amount of money that I never dreamed was possible as a nurse. And then she's like, but I'm enjoying retirement and the value of my portfolio is up because stocks are up a ton and I don't need the money. So I'm just going to relax and stay at home and stay safe. So that in a nutshell is kind of what's going on in the economy right now. Remember I said low labor force participation rate, people that could work don't need to. If you are over 40, let's say, or maybe especially over 50, let's say over 50, if you're over 50, there's a good chance that you don't need to work right now. Because if you're a homeowner, right, a lot of people that are over 50 bought their homes a while ago, so they might have an absolute moonshot of home equity that they've experienced this past year, right? Think about people that have bought their homes in like the 90s. Oh my gosh, they made so much money just being homeowners. Then you think about retirement savings, which people's retirement savings, if you've held on the past 10 years, just not touched anything, your retirement savings has probably tripled. So you've got all these older workers that have way more money than they thought they would have at this point with way more intense sort of negative working environments in a lot of cases, right? You know, if my mom went to be a nurse again, it's not going to be normal, pandemic-free, like people aren't wearing masks, people are relaxed, you can really come close and hug somebody if they're really experiencing a terrible loss or something, right? The whole family is there in the hospital, in the waiting room to try to be there for them. You don't get any of that. So it's just so stressful now to do a lot of different jobs that involve human contact. So those are a lot of the reasons why inflation's going on. I hope it's transitory. I hope it's temporary because long-term inflation that's high is actually not good for most people, especially lower income people, but it's not good for higher income people either. It's not really good for anybody except, I guess maybe it's good for borrowers, but then again, like I've showed you in this podcast today, it's not good for all borrowers. It's only good for certain ones now that we've got so many people on these income-based repayment plans where their payments will go up if there's bad inflation because that causes a rise in wages, which causes rising IBR payments. Just a quick business note, we're doing everything we can to expand availability right now. We just promoted a couple consultants to do more higher debt consults. We're probably going to maybe even add potentially, maybe. I don't know. We'll kind of do a wait and see approach if we're going to add consultants, because I really love the team that we have right now, because everybody's got hundreds of plans under their belt. We don't have anybody that's new on the team, which is great, because going into the payment restart, there's tons of chaos. And so it's really nice to have that experience on the team so that I don't have to worry about anybody being kind of new that's giving advice. So just know that it's at least a month out for bookings, studentloanplanner.com/book. Maybe some people might be as available as soon as a couple weeks, which is nice. And so I would highly recommend that if you're going to get a plan or a follow-up plan, reserve it now for like whatever time you think you would want it. So if you're thinking, hey, I might want a follow-up plan in late January, you can reserve that right now. You don't have to wait. So go in and book that plan. And guess what? If you don't end up using it, what you can do is we ask that you give us 24 hours notice, but you can cancel that plan as soon as 24 hours before it happens with no penalty, no fee or anything like that, because we don't collect a credit card for you to book the plan and we bill after the fact just to make sure that you got value out of the consult, right? So I would reserve a spot if you're wanting one, because I guarantee you in January, if you wait till January to email me or our team, we're not going to probably have spots for a while. So just a lot of longtime podcast listeners, a lot of you will never need to book a plan or not want to book a plan. I respect that. It's your decision. A lot of follow-up existing clients will listen to our podcast that might not need a follow-up plan because we knocked it out of the park on your first one. Great. Awesome. Just thought I'd share this just because I think there's enough people listening to the pod that are waiting for the right time that need to know, at least to set expectations, what kind of level of service and availability we're going to be able to provide. Another thing is with refinancing, how do you plan that? Well, some of the rates are starting to change. There's probably only one or two lenders right now that are offering like low 3% 20-year fixed rates. I think that's going to go away pretty soon, where it's going to be mid to high 3% fixed rates for 20-year fixed. I could be wrong. This is just my sense. So if it was me, if I was really thinking about paying my loans back over a long period of time, then I would probably apply sometime in late November or December, and then I would wait 30 days because your rate is generally good for 30 days once everything's fully submitted. So I would find out when it expires, and then I would hit that offer near the end of that 30-day period. So you maximize your interest subsidy from federal government, get yourself a longer look at like economic conditions and the new IBR plan that might be coming out, right? And that way you can make a really informed decision when you decide to accept that offer in, say, January 2022. And certainly if you want to wait until February 1st and you want to call your servicer up and verify that, yes, you had X amount of daily interest that was charged to you today to make sure that, you know, there's not a fourth wave that causes us to extend this student loan pause again, you could do that. But I think it's very clear the Department of Education is extremely serious about restarting payments on schedule. We just had a new columnist on our site that analyzed like the scenarios where they could extend it. And his conclusion was that it's definitely starting January 31st. And he's called out previous extensions that have happened in the past. So it certainly seems extremely clear that it's going to start. Of course, if you're trying to apply studentloanplanner.com/refi, we've got those $1,000 plus bonuses up to that level for refinancing large amounts. And I'd love to get your questions. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you want to ask a question for the podcast I can cover in a future episode. Well, thank you, everybody. Stay safe from that evil inflation monster. I guess, what's the William Jennings Bryan, you know, 1896 campaign equivalent of 2021? Maybe it's do not crucify America on a cross of student loans. Maybe that'll be a campaign slogan in 2024. I don't know. But inflation has been around for a long time. It just hasn't been around in many of our lifetimes, in our conscious lifetimes. So maybe call your mom, call your dad, call your grandparents, and they'll love you for it. And then just ask them a couple questions about inflation just to get some life experiences that you maybe have not heard about before. So thanks, everybody, for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. I'm Travis, and have a wonderful rest of your week.